The Greeks, in kindling a flame at the Olympic Games, engaged in a ritual that bespoke their belief in the divine-human divide. While for us, the kindling of fire epitomizes God's mercy, our reliance upon the divine, as well as the divine-human partnership. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, Episode 40, The Olympic Flame and the Light of Hanukkah. I am Meir Soloveitchik. Let us speak of the Olympic torch. Today, what is seen as a sublime symbol of the Olympics is the torch relay, in which the Olympic torch, first kindled in Greece, is carried around the world by a series of runners until it is finally brought into the Olympic Stadium to light the Olympic flame. People love it, but what most do not know is that this was never part of the original Olympics and that it was actually the brainchild of the staff of Goebbels, and that the first time that a torch relay took place was in the Nazi 1936 Olympics. The kindling of an Olympic flame does date back to ancient Greece. There it served as a pagan celebration of a figure from Greek myth. As the Encyclopedia Britannica informs us, quote, "Whereas the Olympic rings are strictly a modern symbol, the tradition of the Olympic flame is one that connects the modern games with their ancient heritage. In the ancient Greek Olympic Games, a large basin of fire was kept alight for the entirety of the ceremonies and competitions. The constant flame mirrored the theft of fire by the Titan Prometheus, humanity's supposed creator, from the Greek god Zeus," end quote. Thus, the Olympic torch relay, the bringing of a bit of fire from Greece across Europe to Berlin, was the Nazi way of linking themselves to Greece, of their seeking to take the mantle of Prometheus upon themselves. This, needless to say, is not well known today. But what is even less well known is that the tale of Prometheus is actually bound up with the Greek concept of sacrifice, and that only an understanding of Greek myth will allow us to see how the Jewish concept of temple offerings is so profoundly different, involving a clash of worldviews that relates to the symbolism of fire and the very nature of the divine. It was in the 170s BCE that Antiochus III, known as Antiochus the Great, under whom the Jews lived in peace, was followed by his son Antiochus IV, known as Antiochus Epiphanes the Illustrious, or Epimanes the Insane. Antiochus IV was a passionate apostle of Hellenistic culture. Though he ruled from Syria, his dedication to all that Athens embodied can be seen today in the ruins of what was once the largest Greek temple in Athens and the world, the Temple of Olympian Zeus, which was conceived by Antiochus IV. And this king's enthusiasm for paganism encountered an enthusiastic response from many Jews in Jerusalem. One of them was a Kohen, a priest of the temple named Yeshua, who was the younger brother of the high priest Chonio, or Onias. Yeshua, who adopted the Greek name Jason, convinced Antiochus, through bribery, to install him instead to the high priesthood. At this point, Jason incorporated Hellenism into all of Jerusalem, creating a Greek gymnasium at the foot of the Temple Mount, a site that served as a gathering place for Jews in Jerusalem enthusiastic about embracing the pagan aesthetic. As the second book of Maccabees reports, Jason, quote, "took delight in establishing a gymnasium right under the citadel, and he induced the noblest of the young men to wear the Greek hat. There was such an extreme of Hellenization and increase in the adoption of foreign ways because of the surpassing wickedness of Jason, who was ungodly and no true high priest, that the priests were no longer intent upon their service at the altar. Despising the sanctuary and neglecting the sacrifices, they hurried to take part in the unlawful proceedings in the wrestling arena after the signal for the discus throwing, disdaining the honors prized by their ancestors and putting the highest value upon Greek forms of prestige," end quote. Meanwhile, Jason himself was insufficiently pagan for some other Athenian enthusiasts, and another Jerusalemite by the name of Menelaus, who may not have been a Kohen at all, somehow convinced Antiochus to install him as high priest instead. When the Seleucid king was at war with Egypt and a rumor went around that he had died in battle, Jason attempted to overthrow Menelaus, but it turned out that Antiochus was very much alive. The Seleucid king then sent his general Apollonius to reinstall Menelaus and to back him up with hard power, leading to the enforced paganization of Jerusalem and Judea. Thus Maccabees recounts. Many, even from Israel, gladly adopted the king's religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and feasts, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. End quote. Thus was the temple ritual replaced with paganism, and it was on the 25th day of Kislev, remember that date, ladies and gentlemen, that the altar in Jerusalem was first utilized for worship of Greek gods. It is important at this moment to emphasize one point. The story of Hanukkah as involving a Gentile assault on Jewish religious practice. Much of the story will indeed involve just that, but the story begins with a zealous embrace by many Jews, including sacred families of Jerusalem, of Hellenism and paganism. It is in describing the moment that the temple was first desecrated that the Talmud emphasizes this Jewish embrace. The rabbis describe a member of a Kohanic priestly family, a daughter of the house of Bilga, who became a pagan and married a member of the Greek army. On the day that the Hellenists entered and desecrated the temple, this member of Jerusalem's Jewish elite kicked the temple altar and accused it of stealing money from Israel, saying, "Wolf, wolf, to what extent will you devour the money of Israelites and not defend them in times of crisis?" Here, the Jewish Hellenists referred to the fact that the daily offerings in Jerusalem were funded by annual donations from Jews from around the world. And yet, at first blush, the accusation is strange. This member of a Jewish priestly family has embraced Hellenism. Did not the Greeks offer sacrifices to all their gods in so many more temples around the world? But the explanation seems to be, perhaps, that when it came to Hellenistic pagan rituals, only the bones and fat of the animals were offered to the gods. And this because of the legend of Prometheus. One of the earliest accounts of Greek myth extant today comes from the poet Hesiod. And according to Hesiod, Prometheus originally sought to ensure that when humanity brought animal sacrifices, they could keep most of the best parts for themselves. He therefore suggested that only the bones of the animal be given to Zeus, with the fat covering it, thereby disguising the fact that there was no meat. Interestingly, Hesiod adds, "Because of this, the tribes of men upon earth burn white bones to the deathless gods upon fragrant altars." End quote. In other words, that the legend of Prometheus inspired how Greeks brought sacrifices themselves. But Zeus, Hesiod further writes, was angry at Prometheus' trick and in revenge took fire away from man. Prometheus, in turn, took the fire from Mount Olympus, hid it in a reed, and brought it back to humankind. As punishment, Prometheus was tortured by the gods, his liver pecked out every day by eagles. This, for Greek myth, is what the gods did to heroes. Prometheus was celebrated by the Hellenists, most famously in a play by Aeschylus, Prometheus Bound, as one who suffered unjustly at the hands of the gods because of his greatness and his actions on behalf of humankind. Thus, the legend of Prometheus and the Greek story of the theft of fire is bound up with how sacrifice was brought. The bones for the gods, the meat for mankind. We may well understand now the intent behind the Jewish Hellenistic critique of Jerusalem. For while many offerings in Judaism are eaten, the daily ritual in the temple involved two sacrifices that were given entirely to God. Thus, perhaps these Jewish pagans claim that Hellenism more truly serves the needs of man and is therefore more enlightened. And yet, when we ponder this, we realize that a much larger divide is now revealed between Athens and Jerusalem. For what emerges from the story of Prometheus' sacrificial deception and his fiery theft is this. For the Greeks, the gods were not just. They were propitiated because they were powerful. Prometheus was celebrated because for a moment he overcame their divine power. In stark contrast, as Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein has noted, Judaism balances its own belief in the powers of man with its insistence on man's reliance on God, as well as on God's absolute goodness. And if certain offerings in Jerusalem were given entirely to the divine, in the site in Jerusalem where the Akedah of Isaac once took place. It is because ever since Abraham offered Isaac at that spot and Isaac was saved, we are called to remind ourselves of how entirely we owe our own existence to the goodness and benevolence of God. And in the end, this is linked to Jerusalem's critique of Athens. Judaism has long seen the achievements of Greece, aesthetics, philosophy, math, science, as potentially wonderful things in the history of mankind. But it has simultaneously stressed that they are wonderful only if they are founded on what was always the Jewish insight, the monotheistic message that we are meant to bring to the world. Without this, we have the Greek Empire, scientific and artistic achievement, but also tyranny and sexual immorality. We are therefore able to appreciate how different then is the story that Judaism tells about the gift of fire, how utterly unlike it is to that of Greek myth. According to the Midrash, man was created on Friday, immediately sinned, and his expulsion from Eden was decreed. But this expulsion was temporarily suspended for Shabbat, when the light of creation shined for 24 hours. After the expulsion took place, darkness descended on the world. But, the Talmud tells us, in a great act of love, God took two stones and at that moment instructed Adam in the art of creating fire. In other words, whereas the Greeks saw in fire a rebellion against the gods, we see in it a sign of God's grace following man's rebellion. The Greeks, in kindling a flame at the Olympic Games, engaged in a ritual that bespoke their belief in the divine-human divide, while for us, the kindling of fire epitomizes God's mercy, our reliance upon the divine, as well as the divine-human partnership. The beginning of the desecration of the temple at the hands of Jewish Hellenists thus poses a question to us all. Whose fire do we celebrate? That of Athens or of Jerusalem? That of Prometheus or that of Judaism? What is our guiding light? At this moment in our story, it no doubt appeared to many that the fire of Athens had triumphed. Jewish pagans practiced Greek ritual atop the temple altar, where once the fire of Judaism had brightly blazed. But the Talmud also tells us that as the temple was defiled, one flask of holy oil was hidden away, a flask from which a miracle would soon come. It was Rabbi Jack Sable who once reflected that the Kohen, the priest who hid that oil, is one of the truly unsung heroes of the Hanukkah story. For it was he whose name we do not know, who continued to have faith in the future of Jewish practice in Jerusalem. For but a moment, the fire of Greek myth seemed to have triumphed. But only for a moment, for what is about to follow is the rekindling of Jerusalem's flame, the rekindling of Jewish hope. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.